Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review. My name is Nora Ami. The Happy Couple by Nisha Dolan. 3 years into their relationship, the 20-something Dubliners, Celine and Luke, still did not, as a rule, share feelings. Celine's family never taught her how, so she measures the partnership by the clutter they've accumulated together. It would be so hard to undo. "Marriage will never happen between us," Luke says to her as they lie in bed after a party. "And that's not a problem, necessarily. It would be silly to stop when it's going well. But we're not going to end up together." One page later, he proposes. Nisha Dolan's second novel, The Happy Couple, is a study not of love or romance, but of the motivating force of self-delusion. When Luke is nowhere to be found at their engagement party, Celine tells herself, "Things are fine, fine, fine." When he does turn up, there is something safe about Luke's voice, even when she knows he's lying to her. "What mattered was their potential," she says, "not the tightness in Celine's chest. From Luke, she wanted nothing, really hardly anything, just to be known. What she seeks in marriage is a comforting boundary of self-definition." The Happy Couple hews to the usual contours of what we now call a millennial novel. People in their mid to late 20s, mired in indecision and a gloomy sense of possibility, walk at sunrise after a night of cocaine and ask one another things like, "Do you think I could be happy?" Dolan smirks at the persistence of the question in a social milieu. Celine is a professional pianist. Luke does communications for a tech company. With infinite options for fulfillment, both Celine and Luke's romantic entanglements involve multiple genders and little judgment. Dolan smirks at the persistence of the question in a social milieu with infinite options for fulfillment. Both Celine's and Luke's romantic entanglements involve multiple genders and little judgment. Celine is a professional pianist. Luke does communications for a tech company. A supporting cast fills out the millennial novel universe. Celine's sister has only the usual signs of wear: mild nutritional deficiencies, self-diagnosed anxious attachment style, self-diagnosed avoidant attachment style, stiff neck from excessive phone use. And her ex-girlfriend Maria learns in therapy that "I'm not responsible for how people treat me." All the deflection of agency and commitment becomes a bit glib. It was the very act of choosing that Luke couldn't stand, and if he ever accidentally made a choice, he'd promptly do something to unchoose it, Dolan writes. In one of many epistolary-style inserts of drafted groom's speeches, Luke waxes nostalgic for an ex with whom he play-acted a different relationship each night. "And these ersatz partnerships were far more fun than the real one we'd attempted. More focused on their self-narrated arc than they are on their actual lives and the people in them, Dolan's characters may have far more freedom than Jane Austen's, but it doesn't mean they're any happier." The head-on consideration of marriage forces a certain heavy-handedness on the novel. Dolan seems to have felt obliged to smuggle in bromides about the system, heteronormativity, and patriarchy, as well as cursory revelations like "nobody knew anyone, not fully," and "love is letting people hurt you." The most profound confession Luke arrives at is, "Honestly, I'm not great at knowing what I want." Why bother with a centuries-old marriage plot in a no-stakes, no-strings-attached world of total freedom to change one's mind without consequence? In his 2011 novel, The Marriage Plot, Jeffrey Eugenides and his protagonist, Madeline, a bright-eyed literary theory major at Brown, asks whether the novel of love can persist in a postmodern world, let alone in an increasingly polyamorous, boundaryless one more than a decade later. Dolan joins this lineage of contemporary writers who have tried to both revive the marriage plot for this century and show their characters writhing in new ways against its constraints. Celine and Luke approach matrimony more as an abstraction to ponder and throw out like anything else than as an institution with a real power to impose. But at times it feels like an easy narrative crutch, allowing Dolan to short-circuit toward conclusions like marriage isn't good or bad, successful or unsuccessful. It just works or it doesn't. Still, we may always need the device. Marriage affords great collective excitations, Roland Barthes wrote. If we managed to suppress the Oedipus complex and marriage, what would be left for us to tell? Prophet Song by Paul Lynch. A novel titled Prophet Song promises some degree of timeliness, and indeed it comes at a moment when the fear it addresses is daily in the news, that the social contract is about to break, that what we think of as ordinary life is about to be transformed into a constant existential struggle, which will be played out not in a state of nature, but in something arguably worse, at the fault line between opposing ideologies. This week, the novel by the Irish writer Paul Lynch won the Booker Prize. The story is set in a version of contemporary Dublin. There's a brief reference to a pandemic early on. Molly, the protagonist's teenage daughter, has been disinfecting door handles, taps, and toilet flushers to stop the spread of a virus familiar enough to all of us that it doesn't need to be named. But it makes no further appearance. The purpose, really, is to set the mood, apocalyptic, and a stage from which the trauma of the past few years can slide almost imperceptibly into a disaster less familiar. Eilish, Molly's mother, hears a knock at the door. There are two policemen outside who want to speak to her husband, Larry. It is nothing to worry about, one of them says, though of course Eilish starts to worry and questions her husband when he comes home. A cloud no bigger than a man's hand, as the saying goes, has appeared on their horizon. Eilish is a biologist who works for a biotech company. Larry is the deputy general secretary of the teachers' union. They have four children and live comfortable middle-class lives with all of the usual anxieties, battles with teenagers, fights with aging parents. But the tone from the beginning has a suppressed intensity. The novel opens with Eilish staring wistfully at garden trees. A National Alliance Party has recently taken control and passed an Emergency Powers Act. Larry, as a frontline trade unionist, is in the government's sights. A big demonstration is planned. Eilish doesn't want him to go, but eventually relents. They live in a free society, after all, with a constitution and the rule of law. So he marches. What follows is a descent into chaos. To get us there, Lynch makes a number of significant decisions. The emergency is never explained. Maybe it was entirely the invention of the National Alliance Party. This means that the political crisis here is a kind of blank. It has no history. There are opposing sides, the nationalists versus everyone else, eventually called the rebels. But we never learn what they're arguing about, apart from the rule of law. That the story is set in Ireland, with its long history of sectarian conflict, gives gravity to this absence. We hear occasional church bells, but no real mention of religious difference, or even unionist or anti-unionist attitudes. There is, however, a border to the north, which becomes one of the possible outlets for emigration. Lynch stays deliberately vague, partly so that the story can serve as a more general allegory, but there's a cost to the allegory, too. Without an emergency, without any kind of immediate history, it's hard to understand what the nationalists are fighting for, and so they become not ideological opponents, but a mindless destructive force. When one of Eilish's colleagues, a man who wears an NAP pin on his lapel, is promoted above her for political reasons, she looks into his eyes and sees in the face an abyss. In other words, it's hard to sympathize with them. Lynch, of course, isn't asking us to, but without some moral ambiguity, there's a danger that a novel like this can turn into an instance of preaching to the choir. We know who the baddies are, and it's not us. We're not complicit in whatever has gone wrong in this society. The worst we have to fear is that we might become victims of something similar. All your life you've been asleep, all of us sleeping, and now the great waking begins. The other big decision is stylistic. There are sections and chapters in the novel, but no paragraphs. Dialogue is not punctuated with quotation marks and is often interrupted by descriptions and sudden dives into interiority, all of which means that following a conversation takes some detective work. But it also suggests that there's no real difference on the page between a thing said and a thing thought. You can feel the paranoia creeping in. Thinking is as bad as saying. Saying is as futile as thinking. As Eilish moves further from her ordinary middle-class life, Lynch has to build the story out of some other kind of material. The lyric momentum of the prose has to do much of that work. There are many, many lines and passages of great beauty and power. The weight of her body has come to rest in her skull so that she dizzies against the wall. Lynch is very good, too, at low-key but vivid and instantaneous scene setting. A low and cold grayness and the fire and ashes, litter strewn about the fallow field. But there are also times when Lynch doesn't quite trust the situation he has put his characters in to carry the emotional weight, and the metaphors start to get in the way. How an instant can slow and open upon some field of other time. She is wading without light through a compounding darkness, fearing the surroundment of wolves. This is not a funny book. It's fairly relentless, even before things go haywire. I wouldn't have minded a little more acceptable, less intense life. As Eilish herself reflects, happiness hides in the humdrum. It's successfully hidden here, and without humor, as Martin Amis once wrote, a person must rig up his probity ex nihilo. There's nothing to show that a writer is trustworthy. And yet, as the novel goes on, as catastrophe deepens, relentlessness itself proves persuasive. Lynch is extraordinarily good at the bureaucratic intricacies of the descent into chaos. We follow Eilish from hospital to hospital as she tries to track down her wounded son, make contact with her declining father, find a way out. There are no paragraphs because there is no relief from anxiety, only an unending sentence that refuses to reach a full stop. After a while, questions of complicity, of seeing both sides, become irrelevant. Prophet Song is less interested in could it happen here than in the follow-up, would you know when to leave? Public collapses expose private fault lines, too. Weaknesses in marriages, bad parenting, personal failures of courage. As we approach the end game, Lynch's decision to leave the political context blank starts to pay off. What's happening to Eilish opens out into a much larger and older story of displacement. As she struggles to find a passage with whatever family she has left into something like civilization. This review was written by Benjamin Markovitz, whose most recent novel, The Sidekick, is about the complicated friendship between a sports writer and an NBA star. Becoming Ella, The Jazz Singer Who Transformed American Song by Judith Tick. Ella Fitzgerald was born in 1917 in Newport News, Virginia, but spent most of her childhood in a poor section of Yonkers, New York. Her father, a longshoreman, left the family when she was young. Her mother did domestic work and toiled in a commercial laundry. Ella didn't make it past junior high. She worked briefly as a lookout for a brothel and was arrested for truancy. She spent time in an institution for troubled youth. She later told a relative she had been molested as a girl. She thought she might become a dancer. Her break came when she was 17 at an amateur night at the Apollo Theater. She got over a bad case of stage fright and sang a Hoagy Carmichael song, Judy. A young Benny Carter was the musical director that night. Among those taken with her in the shows to come was the band leader, Chick Webb, whose music had a hot, powerful style. He hired her. Big band girl singers were fresh bait in those days, Margot Jefferson has written, dangled in front of audiences to soothe their souls and stir their hormones. Some thought Fitzgerald was too plain-looking for the role, but her multi-octave voice and high spirits removed all doubts. Her first hit was A Tisket, A Tasket, which teased jazz out of a nursery rhyme. In Becoming Ella, The jazz singer who transformed American song, Judith Tick, recounts, almost concert by concert, how Fitzgerald was thrown straight into the deep end. In 1938, at the Savoy Ballroom, Count Basie's band faced off against Webb's in a battle of the bands. Billie Holiday was singing with Basie, so it was a battle of vocalists as well. Louis Armstrong and Benny Goodman were in the audience. In his novel, The Interrogative Mood, the one in which every sentence is a question, Paget Powell asks, "Have you decided yet what historical moment you would have most liked to have witnessed with your own eyes and ears? That night at the Savoy would surely be high on many lists." A slew of recording sessions and a lot of travel followed. Goodman tried to poach Fitzgerald from Webb after Webb died of tuberculosis in 1939. At 34, Fitzgerald briefly led his band. Before long, she was recording with Armstrong, whom she learned to lovingly imitate, and touring with Dizzy Gillespie. She performed in the All-Star Concert Series, Jazz at the Philharmonic. Oscar Peterson played with her, and in his memoir, he recounted her imperturbable musical confidence. She was fronting the greatest jazz musicians alive, but she was unfazed. On the finale each night, she courageously took on the frontline horns, regardless of who they were. Ella traded fours, eights, sixteens, or whatever they wanted with them, and never got hurt. As a matter of fact, on various nights when some of the horns got a smidgen careless, Fitz would run up over them and keep right on going. Fitzgerald stared down the jazz critics, too, who felt that vocalists, especially female vocalists, cheapened jazz, diluted it, and stole attention from the playing. Tick is a professor emerita of music history at Northeastern University, whose books include a biography of Ruth Crawford Seeger, the modernist composer who also happened to be Pete Seeger's stepmother. She chronicles the slights and insults Fitzgerald faced as a black woman on tour, especially in the South. During the Civil Rights era, some wished Fitzgerald had been more outspoken. She felt she spoke more clearly through her work. Tick's biography builds toward and finds its sweet spot in Fitzgerald's 8 initial songbook albums for Verve, recorded between 1956 and 1964. She had impeccable taste. She revisited and modernized songs by Cole Porter, Rodgers and Hart, Duke Ellington, Irving Berlin, George and Ira Gershwin, Harold Arlen, Jerome Kern, and Johnny Mercer. In the process, Tick writes, she laid the foundation stones for what would soon be known as the Great American Songbook. Fitzgerald has proved to be a difficult subject for biographers. She could be remote in person and withholding in interviews. A previous biography by Stuart Nicholson in 1994 devolved in its second half into a blur of concert dates. Tick's book delivers the same blur. It's as if a Bob Dylan archivist were dryly printing every set list on his never-ending tour. Like Dylan, Fitzgerald was a hardened road warrior, as if performing nonstop would keep depression and even death at bay. There are decades of television appearances on every talk and variety show, from Glenn Campbell's to Flip Wilson's to Chronicle as well. None of this takes us closer to her. Academic language creeps like mold into this biography. Aretha Franklin's song, Respect, is an intersectional anthem. Elsewhere, the verbiage is as impersonal as a rental car agreement. Black variety entertainment flourished in a separate cultural milieu through entrepreneurial adaptation and new social relationships. Tick clearly reveres Fitzgerald's music, but her prose is buttoned up. She can't quite transmit her enthusiasms or make her distinctions stick. Many listeners, then and now, find Fitzgerald's recordings to be aloof and impersonal. In her introduction to a 2016 book on Billie Holiday, Zadie Smith, channeling Holiday, writes, "All respect to Ella, all respect to Sarah, but when those gals open their mouths to sing, well, to you it's like someone just opened a brand new Frigidaire. A chill comes over you." It doesn't matter that Tick doesn't use Smith's comment, but there is a sense of easy layups missed. There are relatively few female voices in this book, which makes one miss Margot Jefferson's devastatingly fine writing on Fitzgerald. Jefferson has described being embarrassed to watch Fitzgerald on television when she was a teenager because Fitzgerald would sweat on stage. The perspiration threatened to drag her back into the maw of working-class black female labor. In a book short on humanizing detail, I was surprised to find a single sentence devoted to Fitzgerald's cookbook collection. Tick doesn't describe this collection, nor tell you that the 300 or so titles are housed at Radcliffe's Schlesinger Library. Apparently, Fitzgerald didn't cook from these books, but simply loved to read them, which makes her a kindred spirit to me. It's poignant to note that she had diabetes, so she surely could not always have eaten what she longed to. She annotated her cookbooks in the margins. Who would not want to know in two or three paragraphs what she put there? Tick doesn't say, nor does she note that Fitzgerald was said to have floor-to-ceiling bookshelves in every room of her house, and that she kept letters and other things inside her books. It's poor sportsmanship, perhaps, to write about what isn't in a book, as opposed to what is, but even browsing a Sotheby's catalog of Fitzgerald memorabilia auctioned in 1997 gives you a deeper sense of her personal style than Tick manages to convey. According to the Chicago Tribune, a pair of her fake eyelashes sold for $900. Nor does Tick describe Fitzgerald's Beverly Hills house, though there are many photos online. It looks a bit like Larry David's place on Curb Your Enthusiasm, or her rare and elegant cars. She didn't drive, but enjoyed being chauffeured. Unanalyzed, too, is what catnip Fitzgerald was to many of the last century's most incisive photographers, including Lee Friedlander and Annie Leibovitz. Her supposedly plain looks were a blank canvas of a sort into which others read volumes. Tick's book warms again as she approaches the end of Fitzgerald's life in 1996. When she was in failing health, she liked to listen to her old records and try to remember everything. On one of her last days, her son hired a trio of excellent musicians to play for her. They were downstairs, she was upstairs, and the beautiful sound traveled up to find her. This review was written by Dwight Garner. He has been a book critic for The Times since 2008. His latest book is Upstairs Delicatessen, on eating, reading, reading about eating, and eating while reading. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review. My name is Nora Ami. Hercule Poirot's Silent Night by Sophie Hannah. Agatha Christie died many years ago, but Hercule Poirot, her lavishly mustachioed and extravagantly brainy detective, lives on in the British writer Sophie Hannah's loopy whodunits, authorized by the Christie estate. In Hercule Poirot's Silent Night, the detective and his sidekick, Edward Catchpole, are summoned to a house in Norfolk at Christmas by Edward's bossy mother. This is unfortunate. Life contained no greater struggle for me, at least, than time I spent in the company of my mother, Edward says. But someone has been murdered, and Mrs. Catchpole's friend is convinced that her own husband is to be the next victim. The book features a typically Hannah-esque collection of over-the-top neurotics, obsessives, fantasists, and narcissists, feuding siblings, irrational parents, downtrodden in-laws. One improbable thing happens after the next. Sometimes Hannah seems to be having more fun than the reader, but people who approach the book in the playful spirit in which it was written will appreciate her knack for hanging on to the essential mystery, no matter how many amusing distractions she throws our way. Class, a memoir of motherhood, hunger, and higher education by Stephanie Land. In her second memoir, Land describes the challenges of trying to get a college degree as a single mother living below the poverty line. As in her debut book, the blockbuster Made, Land is not just exploring her own story, but also the larger implications of what it means to fall between the cracks of American capitalism. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review. My name is Nora Ami.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.